That Printer of Udell's by Harold Bell Wright, read by Amy Zook on Anchor from Grandma's Bookshelf. Chapter 29, Cameron's Betrayal and Sacrifice. In the little country village of Anderson, where the southern branch of the Memphis joins the main line, a group of excited citizens are standing in front of the doctor's office.
"You're right sure it's smallpox, are you, Doc?"
"There's no doubt about it," answered the physician.
"Who is he?" said one of the group.
"Oh, he won't tell his name, but Jack Lane says it's Frank Goodrich," replied the physician. "He came in day before yesterday on the Memphis from Boyd City, where they had just lost a case or two of the worst form." An angry murmur arose from the little group of men.
"What are you going to do, Doc?" asked the spokesman.
"Well, I've sent to Pleasantville," the doctor answered, "for that nigger who's had the disease, and he'll be in as soon as he can get here. We must find some place out of town for the fellow to stay, though, and let old Jake take care of him." Jim Boyle spoke up.
"Thar's a cabin on my West 40. That's in pretty good shape. A couple of us could fix her up in an hour or two. It's way back from the road, a good bit over a mile, I reckon, and heavy timber, too."
"I know the place," said another. "We were on a fox pass there last winter, and we found him denning in that ledge of rocks about half a quarter on yon side."
"That's the one," said the other. "It's sure out of the way, all right."
"Well," said the doctor, "three or four of you go over there and fix up the cabin as comfortable as possible, and I'll have Jake take him over as soon as he comes."
The cabin, which was built by some early settler, had long been abandoned and was partly fallen into decay. Tall weeds grew up through the ruins where the pole stable had stood, and the roof and one other side of the smokehouse had fallen in, and the chinking had crumbled from between the logs of the house, while the yard was overgrown with brush and a tangle of last season's dead grass and leaves, now wet and sodden with the late heavy rain. Deep timber hid the place from view, and 100 yards in front of the hovel, a spring bubbled from beneath a ledge of rock, sending a tiny stream tinkling away through the forest. Jim Bowles and his helpers had just finished patching up the cabin roof and the floor, after first building a huge fire in the long unused fireplace, when they heard the rattle of the wagon, and between the trees caught a glimpse of a scrawny old horse harnessed with a bit of strap and string to a rickety wagon that seemed about to fall to pieces at every turn of the wheel. Upon the board, used for a seat, sat an old negro, urging his steed through the patches of light and shadow, with many a jerk of the rope lines, accompanied by occasional whack from a long, slender pole. Behind the negro was a long object, wrapped in blankets and comforters.
"Hello," shouted the colored man, catching sight of the cabin and the men. "And dis yar the hospital for the smallpox disease. Dey done told me to follow de road. But for goodness sake, all der yard roads look alike to me in der seer place. Never see such a lonesome old hole as one in all my born days. Reckon dar's any haunts in that der old shack?"
"No, this cabin's all right," shouted one of the men. "But you stay where you are till we get away."
And they began gathering up their tools and garments.
"All right, sir, all right, sir," grinned the negro. "You uns just clear out de way before the ambulance am a-comin'. We done got de right-of-way on this trip, sure."
And so Frank Goodrich was established in the old log house, with a colored man to nurse him. A place was fixed upon, where the doctor and citizens would leave such things as were needed, and Jake could go and get them. 3 days passed, and then by bribes and threats and prayers, Frank persuaded the negro to walk to Pleasantville in the night and post a letter to Reverend Cameron, begging the minister to come to him, telling him only that he was in trouble, and warning him to keep his journey secret. What fiend prompted young Goodrich to take such a course cannot be imagined, but let us in charity try to think that he was driven to it by the fright and the horrors of his condition. Mrs. Cameron was away in the Far East visiting her parents, and when the minister received the letter, he made hurried preparations, and telling Dick that he might be gone several days, left the city that evening. At a little way station named in the letter, he found the negro, with his poor old horse and rickety wagon waiting for him.
"Is you de parson?" asked the colored man.
"Yes, I'm the minister," Cameron answered, wondering much at the appearance of the negro and his strange turnout.
and as he clambered up onto the board seat, he questioned his guide rather sharply, but the only answer he could get was, "Mr. Goodrich done told me to hold my tongue, or he haunt me, and I sure gonna do it. Dis here chill don't want no ghost chasing him round. No, sir. I's done fetch young Mr. Goodrich, and he can tell you what he's had in mind." Needless to say, all this did not add to Cameron's peace of mind, and the moment seemed hours as the poor old horse stumbled on through the darkness of the night. At last they entered the timber, and how the Negro ever guided his crippled steed past the trees and fallen logs and rocks was a mystery to Cameron. But he did, and at last they saw the lights of the cabin. "Dar's the place, sir. Dar yon's the hospital. We done got you all at last." And the colored driver brought the horse to a standstill near the tumbled-down smoking house. "Go right in, sir. Go right in. Don't dar, but Master Goodrich, I'll put away Mose." And he began fumbling at the horse ropes and strings that made the harness. Cameron, burning with impatience and curiosity, stepped to the door of the cabin and pushed it open. By the dim light of the dirty kerosene lantern, he could see nothing at first, but a moaning voice from one end of the room drew his attention in the right direction.
"Is that you, Brother Cameron?"
He stepped to one side of the cot. "Why, Frank, what are you doing here? What's the matter?"
"I'm sick," answered the young man in a feeble voice. "I wanted to see you so bad. I'm awful glad you came."
"But why are you here in this miserable place? I don't understand," said Cameron.
"Smallpox," muttered the sick man. "Folks in town are afraid. The Negro takes care of me. He's had it."
The minister involuntarily stepped back.
"Oh, Brother Cameron, don't leave me here alone," cried Frank. "I can't die like this."
For one brief moment, Cameron trembled. He saw his danger in the trap into which he had fallen. He thought of his work and of his wife, and took one step towards the door and then stopped.
"Oh, I can't die alone," said Frank again.
Then with a prayer to his God for help, the minister made up his mind. "Why, of course I'll not leave you, Frank," he said cheerfully, resuming his seat. "You know that, surely." And so this man of God wrote his friends in the city that he would be detained a few days and stayed by the side of the wretched sufferer in the old cabin in the lonely woods. The disease was not slow in its work, and before many hours had passed, it was clear to Cameron that the end was approaching. Frank also realized that death was not far distant, and his awful fear was pitiful.
"Brother Cameron," he whispered hoarsely as he held his pastor's hand,
while the old Negro crouched by the fireplace smoking his cob pipe.
"I must tell you, I've lived an awful life. People think I'm a Christian, but I've lived a lie."
Then with a look that made Cameron shudder, and in a voice strong with terror, he screamed,
"Oh God, I should go to hell! I shall go to hell! Save me, Brother Cameron! Save me! I've always said you were a good fellow. Why do you let me die here like a dog? Don't you know I want to live? Here, you cursed nigger, go fetch a doctor. I'll haunt you if you don't do as I say."
The colored man, chattering in fright, dropped his pipe in the ashes and half rose as though to leave the room, but sank back again with his eyes fixed on Cameron, who was bending forward, his hand on the forehead of the dying man. "God knows all, Frank," said the minister.
"Yes," muttered the other. "God knows all. All, all."
Then in a scream of anguish again,
"He's been watching me all the time. He's seen me everywhere I went. He's here now. Look, don't you see his eyes? Look, Brother Cameron, look, you nigger. Look there."
He pointed to one corner of the cabin.
"Oh, those awful eyes. Watching. Watching. I fooled men, but I can't fool God. Don't. Oh, Christ, I want to live. Save me.
And he prayed, pleading for Jesus to heal him.
You know you could if you wanted to,
he shouted profanely, as though the Savior of men was present in the flesh. Then to Cameron he said,
I must get out of here. Don't you hear them coming? Let me go, I say.
As the minister held him back on the bed.
Let me go. Don't you know I can't look God in the face? Let me go, I tell you, I'm afraid.
For a moment he struggled feebly, then sank back exhausted, but soon began talking again, and the minister heard with horror the secrets, the dark secrets of his life. Suddenly he ceased muttering, and with wide-open eyes stared into the darkness.
Look there, Brother Cameron,
he cried, hoarse with emotion.
Amy, don't you see her? She disgraced the family, you know, ran away with that low-down printer. But see, look. Who's that with her? Oh, God, it's Kate! Kate! Yes, Kate, I'll marry you. Can't be wrong, you know. You love me. Only we must not marry now, for your father would... Look, Cameron!
His voice rose in a scream of fear.
She's got smallpox. Drive her out, you... Oh, take her away to that cabin in the woods where you kept me. Shh, don't tell anyone, Cameron. She wants me to go with her. She's come to get me. There, look, there's Kate. Kate, I'm coming.
And he sank back on the bed again. The Negro was on his knees trying to mumble a prayer, while the minister sat with bowed head. The lantern cast flickering shadows in the corner of the room. The firelight danced and fell. A water bug crawled over the floor. A spider dropped from the rude rafters. And from without came the sound of the wind among the bare branches of the trees, and the old horse feeding on the dead grass and the moldy leaves about the cabin. Suddenly the sick man spoke once more.
No, sir. I'll never disgrace you. I'm as proud of our family as yourself. I am home. Day.
The sentence trailed off into a few unintelligible words in which only mother and Amy could be distinguished. And then, with a last look about the cabin, from eyes in which anguish and awful fear were pictured, he gasped and was gone. The next day, the old Negro dug a grave not far from the house, and at evening, when the sun was casting the last long shadows through the trees, the colored man and the minister lowered the body of the rich man's son, with the help of the rope lines from the old harness, to its last resting place. A few moments later, the Negro came around to the front of the house.
"Ready to go, sir?"
"Go where?" asked Cameron.
"Why, go home, of course," said the Negro. "I reckon you'll be mighty glad to get away from this here place."
"I'm not going anywhere," the minister answered. "You may unhitch the horse again." The old man did as he was told. Then, scratching his woolly head, he said to himself,
"Never saw to that. I sure be taking care of him next."
In the days which followed, Cameron wrote long letters to his wife, preparing her, with many loving words, for what was, in all probability, sure to come before she could reach home again. He also prepared an article for the Whistler, telling of Frank's death, but omitted all that would tend to injure the young man's character. To Adam Goodrich only, he wrote the awful truth. Other letters, containing requests in regards to his business affairs, he addressed to Dick Faulkner and Uncle Bobby Wicks, and one to the president of the association, in which he had several recommendations in regards to the work. All of these, except for the one to his wife, he placed in the hands of the Negro to be mailed after his death, if such should be the end. Then came the symptoms of the deadly disease, and he calmly and coolly began to fight for his life. But his efforts were of no avail. And one night, just before the break of day, he called the old colored man to his bedside and whispered with a smile, "It's almost over, Uncle Jake."
My master bids me come up higher. Goodbye. You've been very kind to me, and the good father will not forget you. And so, talking calmly of the master's goodness and love, he fell asleep, and the old negro sat with a look of awe and reverence on his dusky face, as a glorious sunlight filled the cabin, and the chorus of the birds greeted the coming of the day. Much that passed in the weeks followed cannot be written here. Mrs. Cameron's grief and anguish were too keen, too sacred, to be recounted in unsympathetic print. But sustained by that power which had ennobled the life of her husband, and kept by the promises of faith that had strengthened him, she went on doing her part in the master's work, waiting in loving patience the call that would unite them again. A month after the news of Cameron's death reached Boyd City, the president of the association called on Dick and spent an hour with him talking of the work. Before leaving, he said, "Mr. Faulkner, in Reverend Cameron's letter to me, he strongly recommended that you be called to take the place left vacant as director of the association. With your consent, I will announce that recommendation at our next meeting. But first, I should like to know what answer you will give." Dick asked for a week to think over the matter, which was granted, and during that time he consulted Elder Wicks. Uncle Bobby only said as he grasped the young man's hand by the door, "Behold, I've set before you an open door." And Dick bowed his head in silent assent. The same day, late in the afternoon, George Udell was bending over some work that he was obliged to finish before going home. His helper had gone to supper, and the boy, a new one in the office, was cleaning up the preparatory to closing for the night. "Don't clean that press, Jim," said Udell suddenly. "What's the matter? Don't you know it's time to quit?" asked the tired youngster, a note of anxiety in his voice. "You can quit," replied George, "but I'm going to run off some of this stuff before I go." And he proceeded to lock up the form. With a look of supreme disgust on his ink-stained countenance, the boy removed his apron and vanished, as though fearing his employer might change his mind. At the foot of the stairs, the apprentice met Clara Wilson. "He's up there," he said with a grin, and hurried on out of the building, while the young lady passed slowly to the upper floor. The stamping of the press filled the room, and Udell, his eyes on his work, did not hear the door close behind the girl, and only when she stood at his elbow did he look up. The machine made three impressions on one sheet before he came to his senses. Then he turned to the young Dally inquiringly.
I thought I'd stop and ask you to come over to the house this evening. Mother wants to see you," said Clara.
"Anything important?" asked George, leaning against the press. "You see, I'm pretty busy now." He shut off the power and stepped across the room as the phone rang. "Hello. Yes, this is Udell's." "I'm sorry, but that'll be impossible. We close at 6, you know. Come over first thing in the morning." "Can't do it. It's past 6 now. I have an important engagement tonight." "All right. Goodbye."
"Oh, if you have an engagement, I'll go," said Clara, moving towards the door.
"You needn't be in a hurry," said George, with one of his queer smiles. "My engagement has been put off so many times it won't hurt to delay a few minutes longer. And besides," he said, "the other party has done all the putting off so far. I'd rather enjoy the novelty."
The young lady blushed and hung her head. And then, "But there, what right do we have to look? It's enough for us to know that Udell's engagement was put off no longer, and that he spent an evening at the Wilson home, where the heart of Clara's mother was made glad by the announcement she'd long wished to hear."
"Land sakes," snapped the old woman. "I do hope you'll be happy. Goodness knows you ought to be. You've waited long enough."
And for just that once, all parties interested were agreed. Charlie Bowen is in an Eastern college fitting him for the ministry. His expenses are paid by Mr. Wicks.
"To be sure," said Uncle Bobby. "I reckon a feller might as well invest in a young man as any other kind of stock, and the church needs preachers who know a little about the business of this world as well as the world that's to come. I don't know how my business will get along without the boy, though. But I reckon if we look after Christ's interests, he won't let us go broke." "To be sure, college only puts the trimmings on, but if you got a Christian businessman, what's all man to begin with, they sure do put him in shape, and I reckon the best ain't none too good for God.
But after all, it's mighty comforting for such an old uneducated sticks as me to know that they ain't the trimmings the good Lord's looking at. You can't tell a preacher by the long words in his sermons no more than you can tell a church by the length of its steeple."
5 years later, two traveling businessmen aboard an incoming passenger train were discussing the business outlook when one pointed out the window to a smoke-shrouded city.
"That town is a wonder to me," he said.
"Why?" asked his fellow drummer, who was making his first trip through that part of the country. "What's the matter with it? Isn't it a good business town?"
"Good business town?" ejaculated the other. "I should say it was. There's not a better in this section. But it's the change in the character of the place that gets me. 5 years ago, there wasn't a tougher city in the whole West. Every other door on Broadway was a joint, and now..."
"Oh yeah, I've heard that," interrupted the other with a half sneer. "Struck by some church revival or something, wasn't they? And built some sort of a Salvation Army rescue and home or mission?"
"I'm not sure what anything about the church revival," returned the other slowly.
"Though they do say there's more church members there now than in any other city of its size in the country. But I'm sure of one thing, they were struck by good common sense business Christianity. As for the rescue home, I suppose you can call it that if you want to, but it's the finest block in the business portion of the city, and almost every man you meet owns shares in it. But here we are, you can see for yourself. Only take my advice, and if you want to do business in Boyd City, don't try sneering at the churches or laughing at their association."
And indeed, the traveling man might well wonder at the change a few years had brought to this city in the great coal fields of the Middle West. In place of the saloons that once lined the east side of Broadway and the principal streets leading to it, there were substantial buildings and respectable business firms. The gambling dens and brothels had been forced to close their doors, and their occupants driven to seek other fields for their degrading profession. Cheap variety and vulgar burlesque groups had the city listed as no good and passed it by, while the best of musicians and lecturers were always sure of crowded houses. The churches of all denominations had been forced to increase their seating capacity, and the attendance at high school and business college had enlarged fourfold. The city streets and public buildings, the lawns and fences even, by their clean and well-kept appearance, showed an honest pride and a purpose above mere existence. But a stranger would notice, first of all, the absence of loafers on the street corners and the bright, interested expressions and manners of the young men whom he chanced to meet. And does this all seem strange to you, listener, as to our friend the traveling man? Believe me, there's no mystery about it. It is just the change that comes to the individual who applies Christ's teachings to his daily life. High purpose, noble activity, virtue, honesty, and cleanliness. God has but one law for the corporation and the individual, and the teaching that will transform the life of a citizen will change the life of a city, if only it be applied. The reading room and institution established by the young people of the Jerusalem Church had accomplished its mission and was absorbed into the larger one established by the citizens, where boys and girls, men and women, could hear good music, uplifting talk, and helpful entertainment, were good citizens, good health, good morals, were all taught in the name of Jesus. The institution was free in every department. Visitors were restricted only by wholesome rules that in themselves were educational. Cooperating with the city officials, it separated the vicious from the unfortunate and removed not only the influence of evil, but the last excuse for it, by making virtue a pleasant and tempting the public to live wholesomely. As a traveling man testified, it paid from a business standpoint, or as Bobby Wicks tells his customers from other towns, "Folks come to Boyd City to live because they ain't afraid to have their boys and girls walk down the streets alone." And after all, that's the best recommendation a city can have. And perhaps the happiest couple in all that happy, prosperous city, as well as the best loved of her citizens, is the young manager of the association, Mr. Richard Faulkner, and his beautiful wife, Amy. But Dick will soon leave his present position to enter a field of wider usefulness at the national capital, for the people declared, at the last election, that their choice for representative was the printer Udell's. But before they leave for their Washington home, Dick and Amy will pay still another visit to a lonely spot near the little village of Anderson. There, where the oaks and hickories cast their flickering shadows on the fallen leaves and brushes, and the striped ground squirrel has his home in the rocks, where the red bird whistles to his mate, and at night the sly fox creeps forth to roam at will, where nature, with vine of the wild grape, has builded a fantastic arbor, and the atmosphere is sweet with woodland flowers and blooms, not far from the ruins of that old cabin, they will kneel before two rough mounds of earth, each marked with a simple headstone, one bearing no inscription save the name and the date, the other this: "Insomuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me."